will be broadcasted. Well, actually, most standard English dictionaries say that the past and future tenses of the word broadcast are exactly that, broadcast and not broadcasted. So, if in doubt, it's probably okay to say broadcasted, and there are a couple of dictionaries that allow for that, but you're probably safest saying, I have broadcast my show. You're listening to A Gramophone with Daniel Wolfe.
So they tell me, I can't recall who said it. I know I never read it.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
You know, I'm a gay person from Los Angeles, California, who grew up with mariachi music and sings Broadway, and you know what I mean? Like, now all of a sudden I'm reconnecting to California, where I'm from, but in a completely different way that I never had before.
Today on Rainbow Country, the music of the Beach Boys, as interpreted by queer music theater artist Michael Longoria. That and more next. So stay tuned for Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hello, my name is Conchita.
And I'm Barbie Q.
And my name is Hardcora.
And we are the Beat Girls.
You're listening to
Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello, and welcome to Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. As always, I'm your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. Well, thanks to you, tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately, listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into an award-winning, nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being a number one LGBT podcast. So today, a spotlight on music theater artist Michael Longoria, whose credits include West Side Story, A Chorus Line, as well as playing Frankie Valli in the Tony and Grammy Award-winning Jersey Boys on Broadway. His film and television work include America's Got Talent, Broadway Under the Stars, and Nickelodeon's Dora the Explorer. Today, he joins me to talk about his new studio album, Catch a Wave, Michael Longoria and the Surf Notes. An album that pays tribute to the music of the Beach Boys. We'll find out about Catch a Wave and so much more in Hour 2, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. Our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, British author Adam Smith reads from his queer history book, Deep Sniff, A History of Paupers and Queer Futures. By the way, the reading is accompanied by the parody song, Just a Quick Sniff of Paupers, from drag duo Cookie and Kashida.
just a lad, I learned that anal sex was bad. The church said it was a dirty, rotten sin. But then I learned from other guys that no matter what the size, there's a simple trick to help you take that tick. Just a quick snip of poppers helps the penis slide right in. The penis slides right in, you can take it with a grin. Just a quick snip of poppers helps the penis slide right in the most delightful way.
In the winter of 1866, actually, while a medical student in Edinburgh Royal Infirmary, Brunton met a patient called William H. This young man was only 26, but already had trained as a blacksmith, and then switched to tollkeeper. His first job may have required too much exertion for him to continue, because Brunton's notes reveal that William suffered from heart trouble. When Brunton met him, William had recently been hit by a dull, heavy pain about the left nipple every 3 days or so, lasting for at least half an hour. The pain had come on after years of infrequent attacks ever since he'd suffered from rheumatism as a child. After a three-week hospital stay earlier in the spring, William was back just before Christmas. Doctors gave him aconite, which slows the heart rate, and digitalis. When neither worked, Brunton gave him brandy. The strong stuff didn't help either, so there was only one thing for it. The experiment was not a stab in the dark. Brunton acted in a way that was consistent with his wishes to take basic research from the lab to the bedside, and only with a decent understanding of the actual effect in the body. He had read the work of another scientist, Richardson, that amyl nitrite dilated blood vessels, and had even discussed the effect with his colleague in Edinburgh, Arthur Gamgee, who had made some unpublished measurements of this effect. Brunton obtained some amyl nitrite from Gamgee, who made it for him, and consent for an experiment from his supervising physician. And this is how Brunton came to give his patient William amyl nitrite. On March the 12th, 1867, Brunton observed, "The pain came on as usual at 3 a.m. A few drops of nitrite of amyl were put on a towel and inhaled by the patient. The primary effect noticed was a suffusion of the face, and the patient felt a glow over his face and chest. The pain disappeared almost simultaneously with the occurrence of these phenomena, but returned in 3 minutes. He then inhaled 5 drops more. The pain again disappeared and did not return."
I met this guy once in a bar who took me outside to his car. He spread my cheeks and tried to ram it in. I screamed, "No, it's too big." He said, "Take it all, you pig." Then he shoved this small brown bottle up my nose. And girl, I gotta tell you something. That quick snip of poppers helped the penis slide right in. The penis slide right in. Now I can take it with a grin. Just a quick snip of poppers helped the penis slide right in the most delightful way.
Good queer performers push their audiences forward into the future they desire. A good performance is utopia, for a moment. In the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, all of these potential utopias were willed away when the police stormed in. Performances interrupted, orgasms foregone, connections broken. The police brought their alternative performance. The police did not just want to stop what was happening, they wanted to make their own utopia for a moment. They pulled on their costumes and they put themselves to work on embodying authority, power, intimidation. As individual officers, people with homes and hobbies, they had been moved by some newspaper stories about a deadly sex craze and by others that spoke of a horrible illness killing men who had sex with each other. They heard the words of politicians who spoke about preserving families and protecting children. As individuals, they may even have wanted no more gay or queer people. As an organized group of individuals, each wanting to belong to something bigger than they were, police officers were grabbed by the idea of cutting the number of queer venues. All we have is the records of their group performance, the way they stopped gay and queer people. They arrested our futures, at least for a night or two. The story of these raids is a story from the past, but it is about how we live in the present, creating a future. In every moment we are performing, making choices about the future we want to build for ourselves and others. We can be inspired by other people who are better than us at articulating a future, but it is not some distant, formless thing. How we are living now is always creating a future, whether we like it or not. Whether or not we are trying, we are performing a future. As a genderqueer dancer stretches the limbs they have, they bring us into their utopia for a moment.
Wow, this stuff is amazing!
Here, let me try some. I've never done it before.
Wow, this is hot.
Shit.
Hey, Cookie, let's put something in my ass and see if it works.
I just dropped the whole thing on the carpet. Here, bend over. Let me try this chair.
Oh, my God, I can't even feel anything.
Shit, the whole thing fits.
Wow, the room is spinning right now. These are great, but you know what? You can't use them if you're taking Viagra.
Why?
Well, because you'll die.
Oh, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Wow, this stuff is amazing. So this goes out to all the guys who are too concerned with size. It really doesn't matter anymore. As you watch his manhood grow, shove that bottle up your nose. Relax,
relax
your hole,
your hole,
and slide down on that pole. Just a twist if the bubbles have the penis slide right in. The penis slide right in. You can take it with a grin. Just a quick slip of bubbles have the penis slide right in.
In the most delightful,
making it not frightful.
In the most delightful.
'69 was a big year. It was the year that saw both the Stonewall riots in New York and more or less decriminalization of gay sex in Canada. The following year, the Americans celebrated the anniversary of Stonewall with Christopher Street Liberation Day. That was the summer of 1970. They didn't actually call it Pride at the time. August 1st, 71 was Toronto's first official gay picnic at Hanlon's Point. It was organized by the Community Homophile Association of Toronto and Toronto Gay Action. 300 people showed up. Now, that wasn't officially a pride, but Gerald Moldenhauer, one of the veterans of those days, maintains that a march down Yonge Street a few weeks later should be called the first Toronto Pride. That was a warm-up for the more famous We Demand demonstration in Ottawa, held August 28th that year, a protest against the inadequacies of Trudeau's decriminalization. By the way, if you want to see some pictures of those early days, check out Gerald's website. It's geraldmoldenhauer.com, and it's spelled J-E-A-R-L-D-M-O-L-D-E-N-H-A-U-E-R. The first official Toronto Pride was actually the next year, 1972, again in August. Then there was a second Gay Pride Week, August 17th to 26th, 1973. That one was national, not just Toronto. There were events and marches in Vancouver, Saskatoon, Ottawa, Montreal, and Halifax. The focus was political, on ending discrimination against queers, something that was still quite legal across the country at the time. Then, the following year, 1974, there was Pride number 3 in Toronto, August 17th. I came out of that one, so I remember it very, very well. We marched over to Queen's Park to again demand human rights protection. And then they stopped. There was nothing in 75. People were focused on a national lesbian and gay conference in Ottawa. And again in 76, all of us in Toronto were busily preparing to host the fourth national lesbian and gay conference, which happened in September. Gay Days was a big festival in 78, but nothing called itself Pride again until 1981 after the Bath Raids. That's where the misconception that Pride began after the Bath Raids comes from. 81, I suppose, is significant because that's when the shift happened from August to the last weekend in June to harmonize with Prides across the U.S. But that's not the first Pride. So when you hear someone say that the first Toronto Pride was in 1981, you should politely point out that that's not quite true. Toronto and other cities in Canada had our own August Prides for almost a decade before that. And there are still those of us around who remember. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
Up next, queer music artist Michael Longoria.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Rainbow Country.
Michael Longoria. Hi, how are you?
Hey, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm on cloud nine. I just, you know, had a major release of an album. So like, I just feel so happy that I'm putting some art out there into the world.
You just gave birth.
I gave birth. I sure did. And I didn't feel a thing.
The epidural, girl. The epidural.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Okay.
So you are a performer. You are a music theater baby. You are an actor. You are a musician. Your current project is the album Catch a Wave, Michael Longoria and the Surf Notes. Catch a yes. Wave, Michael Longoria and the Surf Notes. Talk to me about this new release, this new album, and essentially the sonic landscape. What is this record all about?
Yes. Okay. So, you know, about, I don't know, 2 years ago, I was just kind of like looking for some inspiration. You know, I realized my last album I released was in 2019. It was Love Ballads of the Movies. It's called Like They Do in the Movies. There was an original song that I wrote. But then the pandemic happened, and then a bunch of stuff happened. My father passed. I was getting divorced. The group that I was working with, we were all calling it quits. So it was this kind of like world trauma that we were all experiencing with the pandemic, and then like having no artistic outlets because we couldn't perform in front of people. And then on top of that, all the personal stuff that was happening, it just kind of like knocked me down artistically. And for so many years, I couldn't really find the inspiration to really, you know, record again until about 2 years ago. I rediscovered the Beach Boys. I mean, I've always known the Beach Boys because, you know, I've sang Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons for the past 20 years since Jersey Boys, and the Beach Boys were their contemporaries. So like, I always had some of the Beach Boys songs in my, you know, my background, and we all grew up with them in the States. But it wasn't until I really dove into them that I realized they're so deep. And not only that, but like Brian Wilson had this huge falsetto that I guess I realized, you know, when I would hear the Beach Boys, they had falsetto in there, but I didn't realize that it was the guy who was writing the songs. So it just kind of like opened my ear and mind and heart. And I thought, why don't I really dive into this catalog? And I just discovered that I bonded with it in such a enormous way that I didn't expect. You know, I'm a gay person from Los Angeles, California, who grew up with mariachi music and sings Broadway. And you know what I mean? Like now all of a sudden I'm reconnecting to California where I'm from, but in a completely different way that I never had before. And I'm so inspired that I had to put my own version of my favorite songs on this album so that somebody out there can now discover these amazing songs that maybe they didn't know. You know, I up until 2 years ago, I didn't know a lot of these songs that I recorded, and now they're like, I can't believe I never knew them until now. But you know, now I do, and I think that's such a beautiful testament to the writing. You know, these are songs from 1960s. It's 50 years later, and I'm discovering them for the first time. So I'm hoping that other people can discover them through me, and just, you know, I put so many harmonies, these beautiful harmonies on this album that there's not going to be any excuse. Even grandma's going to find a part to sing, you know what I mean? Put her on the bass. But yeah, so it's been a labor of love, and I'm so just proud that it's out there.
So Catch a Wave, it celebrates the music of the Beach Boys. And you were just telling us about, you know, rediscovering the Beach Boys and discovering some of this material for the first time. But was there a moment, was there a spark that made you go, the Beach Boys, that's the ticket? Was there that moment for you that made you go, this is the group that I want to focus on?
Well,
as opposed to maybe mariachi music. And
yeah, well, yeah, I feel like I've done mariachi, you know, like I did that for so long in my youth, but I may revisit that in the project in the future. But with the Beach Boys, it was just kind of like I made a career singing in the 1960s genre, right? So like I did Jersey Boys. I for the past several years, I've been touring with the Midtown Men, which sings all the 60s groups. My Christmas album was all 60s inspired. It's just kind of been like this musical inspiration around my life and my, I guess, my trajectory as a singer. So when I heard, actually, the song that I heard was The Warmth of the Sun. Now, The Warmth of the Sun, it was originally inspired by the national tragedy of JFK's assassination. And Brian Wilson was so, like, moved by the national grief that he had to write it down. He had to do something with that energy. So as any artist would, he put it into what he does, which was songwriting. But he didn't do the lyrics, right? So he had this music that was inspired by this tragedy. And then his writing partner, Mike Love, took that. And then he started to write a song. And the song that came out was a song about loss, but it was about the loss of a love, somebody who's no longer there. But yet, even though they're no longer there, you still have the warmth of the sun, like it's basically like the warmth of God or whatever you believe in, the universe. You still have love in you. So it was just interesting to hear the inspiration of such a beautiful song was inspired by such a different story and a different tragedy. And it just kind of goes to show, like, inspiration can, you know, keep going, you know, beyond whatever that first initial tragedy was or initial fun time was. It could really inspire a beautiful song like that. And on top of that, the song starts with a high falsetto. So, like, you know, I thought originally when I heard it come on the playlist, I was like, is that Frankie Valli? You know, because is this one of the songs that I didn't do? Like, what is this? And then I realized, no, that Brian Wilson had this amazing falsetto. And, you know, they had so many voices on the tracks that it wasn't as prominent as it was when Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons put falsetto in records. Like, you hear they're like, Big Girls Don't Cry, you know, it's like very falsetto prominent. But then you hear songs like, you know, Catch a Wave, and it is in there, but it's kind of like in the back ethereal, you know, kind of creating the vibe of this wall of sound, which is also, I think, what Brian Wilson was trying to do with his music. He was so inspired by Phil Spector and the genre, you know, Ronnie Spector and the Ronettes and that classic wall of sound that I think he was trying to recreate his version, you know, doing with his brothers and his cousins that were in the group and all the different instruments that he used. So I just really thought that was the entrance for me was that song, The Warmth of the Sun.
Mm. Michael Longoria and the Surf Notes. Michael Longoria and the Surf Notes. The Surf Notes. Who are the Surf Notes?
Well, the Surf Notes are my band, the band that I've been touring with, as well as the two vocalists, James O'Black and Sean McGee. These are guys that I've worked with, you know, throughout, you know, the past several years of different gigs. But I've kind of honed in on them because I just have always been a fan of their talent. And I thought when I was creating the live version of what this project would be, I was like, well, I can't sing all the, you know, I can't sing all the harmonies like they did on the album. So I have to find some voices that will blend well with mine. So I found these guys, and I realized that they were there the whole time. And we started to work on this material and like the summertime. And, you know, before you knew it, we had an entire show, and now we have this band that we're calling the Surf Notes, that is right now dedicated to really celebrating these amazing songs, not only from the greatest era of songwriting in the 1960s, but really honing in on these specific guys that really contributed to the soundscape of the whole world, really, but especially in America over here, like the Beach Boys kind of, you know, you hear a Beach Boys song, it's just kind of like, you just feel like, oh yeah, that's like a baseball game, you know, like mm-hmm. I'm out with my dad on a drive, you know, that kind of thing. So
it's in our DNA.
It's in our DNA. And to kind of like be reproducing it, like, you know, ourselves are constantly reproducing themselves. And, you know, it's interesting to do that in an artistic way, you know, to take an art and take somebody's expression and then use your body and your talent and your voice as a vessel to kind of time travel, you know, because in a sense I'm vocally and sonically time traveling to this specific time when this person wrote this song, who's no longer with us, right? And Brian's no longer here. Mike still is, but Brian's no longer here. But through me and through this voice and through this band recording, you're hearing some of his heart and soul, right? His spirit is coming through, and we're literally singing and speaking harmonies that are from a different time. And to be able to do that and do it well, you know, with the team that I was able to assemble were the most talented guys I know. And the fact that they all said yes was like such a blessing. So, you know, I was really impressed with their effort too, you know, because we were in a sweaty studio in the middle of the summer trying to record these songs. And, you know, it was a small little New York studio in Soho, and we all were just like crammed in there, but we jammed. And, you know, I was just floored. And the guys were very surprised. They're like, oh, we didn't realize you're going to actually do like a really good album. Like, we thought you were just doing like a demo track, you know. So they were pleasantly surprised with how well they came off, you know, sounding together. So, you know, I'm really proud of this album, and I really hope people get to listen to it.
Well said, well said. Okay, your debut solo album, 2016's Broadway Brick by Brick, reached number two on iTunes vocal charts. First of all, congrats on that.
Thank you so much.
When you found out that you had a number two album on your hands, when you found out that you had a number two record, what went through your mind? How did that make you feel?
I mean, I didn't really believe it until I saw it. And I, you know, once I saw it, I was like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. How amazing is that? You know, it was a pleasant surprise. You know, Broadway Brick by Brick was all of my favorite, what I considered the golden age of Broadway. You know, when I grew up as a teenager, Chorus Line and West Side Story and Sound of Music. Of course, you know, that's now probably, those are probably not even the golden era now. Those are like way older now. But to me, when I grew up, those were the songs that kind of taught me how to feel emotion. You know, I often talk about how these songs that I discover, I kind of gravitate towards the ones that are like little 3-minute plays so that you're feeling the journey of somebody from start to finish. And usually in that start to finish 3-minute play of a song, it's, you know, the height of a heartbreak or the height of an ask to please be with me, please be my baby, or whatever the lyric happens to be. So I just feel like it's important to pick songs that other people will feel. And if it's a song that tells a real true story, there's, you know, it almost gives somebody the vocabulary to feel something that maybe they needed to feel, you know, something that is trapped inside of them, inside of their heart, or a past trauma that all of a sudden they hear a song and they're singing along to it. And then they're literally verbalizing a therapy, you know, they're getting therapy without knowing, because their body needs to express that word or those tones, you know, those tones need to come out of your spirit. And I really do believe that that's the gift of music. It really, you know, once you know the song, you really have permission and you have a key, you know, all of a sudden you have a key to open this door to like this melodic channel and where you can really express yourself. You know, a lot of people do it in the shower or in the car. But you know, with these songs, you know, that the Beach Boys gave us, they literally gave us like 5-part harmony, 6-part harmony, all these different arrangements where you can really find your lane and sing a part and be able to express something that, you know, maybe you wouldn't have been able to express if you didn't have this song to really give you that, ability to do it.
Mm-hmm. The title, Catch a Wave.
Yes.
Why this particular title?
So, you know, it's interesting. I always pick songs that like people don't really know. And obviously a lot of these songs I didn't know myself, right? I basically knew Fun, Fun, Fun or Help Me Rhonda, Good Vibrations. But the deep cuts, like Catch a Wave, you know, like all of them were equal to me because I was discovering them all at the same time. Even the ones that I was rediscovering, I was actually listening to the words for the first time. I'm like, oh, that's what that's about. So, you know, all that whole time I was discovering it, I didn't think of Catch a Wave. Oh, wait, it's not one of their number one hits. You know, like it was just like, oh, this song really is really interesting. And not only that, for me, like the first line is an invitation. You know, it says, don't be afraid to try the greatest sport around, right? Catch a wave. And to me, I'm always like metaphorical. I'm always like thinking of lines as other things. So like when I heard that, all I heard was don't be afraid to try, you know? And so that kind of like gave me the invitation to be like, you know what? Yeah, why not? Why not do this on my own? And why not really investigate and discover these guys? And you know, honestly, it was kind of like I was a student in college again, and this was a course. And because I wasn't only studying the harmonies by like going to YouTube and hearing all the strips, audio, so you can really hear the vocals and see exactly where they went. You know, so I definitely did that with my arranger. We did all that. But I was also reading their books and hearing their audiobooks, the ones that were narrated by them, and watching documentaries and just seeing their journey and kind of like bonding with them, you know, like not only through their music, but through their story and being able to relate. Cause I'm a singer, you know, I'm a dude who literally discovered my voice as a child and, by the grace of God have been able to have opportunities to use that voice, you know, in my mind for good, you know, when I'm singing out there and I'm making somebody feel happy or I'm making somebody remember, something because of a song that I'm singing, especially these Beach Boys songs, man, these memories that come up for the audience, you can just see them. They're so happy. And that's what it did for me. You know, when I was telling you how uninspired I was at the beginning of this, you know, I listened to that playlist and it changed, it literally changed me. And I know that's weird to say, right? Like what? These old recordings? But yeah, like the effort that this guy made to write these songs and put it down for us, you know, it's magic. And it really changed my heart and soul. And now I really like, I'm walking around smiling more. And I can't help but think it has everything to do with the music I've been singing for the past year, you know, and it's, if I can do that for somebody else, like that's going to be a dream come true.
On that musical note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, this is Amanda Marshall, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B. of TG CD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
If you, or maybe someone you know, would like to be a guest on Rainbow Country to get the word out about an upcoming project, maybe you have an interesting story or journey to share, well, simply head over to marktara.ca where everything is connected and send me an email. It's just that simple. And you too can have your voice and your story be heard coast to coast.
Bill 7, to ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing based on a person's sexual orientation was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill, but without some progressive conservative legislators backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. we were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Hi, this is Claudia Barry, and you're listening to Mark Tara on Rainbow Country.
So Michael Longoria, we're here, we're talking about you, your music, your experiences on Broadway. Let's get to know you a little bit deeper, a little bit better, so to speak. You and I are both part of the LGBT community, and earlier you were talking about, you know, being in a down space in your life. You were married, you were getting divorced. I'm assuming you were married to a man.
Yes.
And here's the question.
Yes.
Growing up, did you think you would be able to marry the man of your dreams at the time?
No.
Growing up.
I know, you know, honestly, well, I grew up in the 90s, so like in the 90s it wasn't even a thing. Like it was beyond taboo in my community, which was really heartbreaking, you know, growing up and discovering that I actually liked guys and that, you know, in the beginning when I didn't really understand what it was just kind of like, oh, I cannot do this, right? This is not allowed. This is something that, you know, we grew up very Catholic and my parents would say things about it around us, you know, like how the sin and all that stuff. So like I kind of grew up with this like general knowledge that, oh, this is probably bad, right? So, but then when I went to the high school for the arts, which was, you know, 45 minutes away from where I was growing up, and all of a sudden there were like kids like me that were gay and they were also like, what? And they didn't care. They were walking around, you know, and they were being themselves. I kind of discovered that little box that I was living in wasn't reality. I mean, it was their reality, right? It was the community that I was growing up in. They had decided that this is the reality of us and these are the rules. But once I discovered, wait a minute, that's not, you know, there's other worlds, there's other communities, and that point of view is literally an ignorant, just like no way to go. So like I, as a young child, like I would often like fight my family and my parents, like, you know, if they would bring something stupid up, like about Ellen, for example. My dad one time walked in and Ellen DeGeneres was on the television and he said, turn that faggot shit off, you know? And I was like, you know, so then like at that point I would start going at my dad, like, don't say, you know, like, how can you say that, you know? So I'd be very like defensive about it, but I kind of just knew that it was, you know, not a thing. I don't know, where was I going with that? Where were we going with that? It was something about being gay.
Well, just growing up.
Oh, about gay marriage, yes.
Did you think that you would be able to marry a man? Because when I was growing up, no.
No, definitely not. And I think, like, you know, for a lot of people, especially, you know, like we were all developing our own kinds of relationships, and we still are as a community. But once it became a legal thing, I think a lot of guys were like, uh-oh, you know what I mean? Like, I got to make a decision or, you know what I mean? Cause a lot of people were just kind of going with the flow about it. But then once it was an option, and then I think it really defined a lot of relationships, and it also made people, have to morph their relationships in order to keep their partners. You know, that everybody's had to like figure out a new version of what marriage really means. So, you know, like that was also part of it for me, like just not really understanding like what I wanted at the time. But yeah, it's amazing that we can. And, you know, when I was a teenager, yeah, I definitely had a boyfriend that I was in love with that I thought I would be with forever. You know, as a 16-year-old kid, you know, I was like, oh my God, I love this guy. You know, and one time I remember him telling me, when we have in the future, when you have another boyfriend, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, what? What do you mean? You know, like the notion that that I hadn't found him. Yeah, I thought I found him. You know, and I was a teenager. So how dumb was I? But I did think, you know, like if we could be together, I was planning on being with this person. So yeah, I guess in my heart of hearts, maybe I always knew it would be an option. But no, I mean, at the time, it was like definitely you had to keep it quiet.
Are you a political person at all?
I don't think I'm political. I definitely am aware, and I'm woke, but you're like meaning like I'm completely aware, and I see like.
So here's a question. What are your thoughts on everything that's happening in America right now with the new, with your current government and who's leading it and the attacks on the queer community, the Latin community? What are your thoughts on all of that, generally speaking?
Well, I feel like we've always been, any of us who've been marginalized or any of us who have been pulled into a small like grouping of people, like an other, we've been othered. This is nothing new. You know, we've always had people that are against us, who don't understand us and who fear what they don't understand. And I think it's really, I mean, it's not really up to us, but if not us, then who? It's up to somebody to like help these people educate them, you know, by just being, you know, and existing. And I think when most people had to be closeted just to survive, you know, in the 70s and 80s, when if you found out you were at a gay bar, you could have your name put in a newspaper, you know, that kind of thing. We've come a long way, but we're always going to have people that are going to stand in our way. But I feel like the more we not only stand up and like, I don't want to say fight, because fight is so aggressive and gross, you know, like I think the more we shine and the more we are successful in our lives and to help
evolve society.
Yeah. That will help evolve society. I mean, I look at my family alone, right? So when I grew up and my family discovered that I had a boyfriend, they flipped out on me, right? They turned their back on me completely. And it was this really traumatic and creepy thing. But I chose to just continue to, I mean, I told them this truth. So like it was, I was acting as like a, somebody who was going to teach them about this, because they were so anti-gay people at the time, you know, because of their upbringing. So I, especially in college, once I got to college and, you know, I was kind of on my own, I kind of made it my job to like talk to my mom about my boyfriends in college or talk to my dad about this guy that I met. And yes, at first they were hella uncomfortable and you could tell, but there was a space between high school and college where we didn't speak, you know, where we were, what do you call it? I guess, I mean, where I always thought they disowned me for a moment. And I also like had to go to New York and pursue my dreams, and I had to do it on my own. So like I was alone in New York for a few years. But I did reach back out to them. And when I would, I kind of started to try to understand them as humans and as people, and not as the people of their circumstances and their community where they grew up in an ignorant environment. And they were like just basically regurgitating what they learned, but they were having to face it with somebody in their family. Their own son was one of these people that they had heard about that was so bad, that was so, you know what I mean? That was living a life that was so horrible. And they had to look at me and be like, well, that doesn't match. That doesn't match with what we're afraid of. And oh my gosh, this is the funny story. I took my dad and my mom to my favorite drag queen show downstairs, like in Hell's Kitchen. It's to the Shaquita show. Shaquita is like this gorgeous African-American, like I don't want to say RuPaul-esque, but like she's even prettier, right? She's gorgeous and she sings opera and she's hilarious. Like she's a hilarious drag queen. Anyway, I take my mom and dad during one of these visits where I'm like, you know, making them see me in my truth. And my dad, like, he was at the end of the show, he was getting up on the stage and trying to pose with Chiquita in the picture. Like, yeah, I have this great picture of me and my mom and my dad, like, you know, like full on machismo guy with the mustache with Chiquita, this tall, gorgeous drag queen. And you know what's funny? Like when he got back to California, he's like, hey, how's Chiquita doing? You know? He was all about like wanting to know like what's Chiquita up to. So like in that example is my little part, if I didn't change the world, I definitely changed their world. Mm-hmm. You know, like I kind of, instead of running away from it, which I kind of had to do to go to college, instead of continuing to run away, I kind of presented myself in a way that like, this is me. And if you want me, if you want your son in your life, you're going to have to see who I am, you know, and you know, maybe it was a little shocking at first. But by their elder years, they were totally fine about it, you know?
Well done. Well done to you. Broadway.
Yes.
Speaking of gay.
So gay.
How many shows have you been on on Broadway?
Well, I've done two major ones. Excuse me. I was in Hairspray on Broadway with Harvey Fierstein. And then I went across the street. I went to Jersey Boys. In the original cast, where I originated the role of Joe Pesci, and I was the matinee Frankie Valli. So I was doing these two parts in that big show, and I did that for a long time. I also originated a role in like a pre-Broadway show that's called Trading Places. And I also did this off-Broadway musical called The View Upstairs. And those are my musical theater, like New York moments. The View Upstairs, I'm on their original cast album, as well as Jersey Boys. So like, that's kind of my stamp at the moment. I mean, I'm hoping that more opportunities come that where I could originate something cool. And I know it will come, but I definitely have to like start writing my own stuff more and continuing to put out albums like I'm doing now. You know, like put out my heart and let people receive it however they will.
What was it like working with Harvey Harvey Weinstein?
Fierstein.
Harvey Fierstein.
I'm like, well, let me tell you, I worked with both. No, I'm just kidding.
Because he is a legend.
Yes, yes, he's a legend. But you know, I knew him from Mrs. Doubtfire. You know, like in that he's the gay brother who puts Robin Williams into drag, and you know, Robin Williams comes and he knocks on his door and he's like, "I need you to make me a woman." He goes, "I'm so happy." Like that's his like line. So that's how I knew of him. So like when I heard he was like the star of the show, I was like, oh wow, that's so amazing. And what's really amazing about my time in the beginning of Hairspray when I first got there was Harvey's like dressing room was on the first floor, but it was like really huge. Or maybe it was in the basement. Well, it was like on the lower floor. And you can go in there like before the show. Like he was usually there like an hour before, and I would always go in there and hang out and be telling him about, girl, let me tell you about B-Bar. Or like, you know, I was like a 20 something year old kid, like telling Harvey all the juicy gossip. And you know, he would tell these stories as well. And he would just primarily just laugh at me because I was just, I'm sure I was a crazy kid. You know, but it was nice to have a gay person leading something and kind of having that be my first experience with Broadway, because it's not really Broadway, you know, unfortunately it's not. That is, I had like the golden egg version of an experience with that. And it was right around the time when George Bush was saying those things about like, no gay marriage. And he was like doing a bunch of crazy shit publicly. And during that time period, we were doing Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS speech, right? Where you raise money for that. And Harvey was always so funny. I'm sure he wrote these things, but as a kid, I was like, he's just saying this off the cuff, like how funny he is, right? So, but he would like start talking and make people laugh. And then he'd be like, and also our president is trying to take away my rights. And like, and he would like get into it with the Broadway community. That was his way of doing what we were talking about, of activism, of standing up in front of people that didn't necessarily know that they were about to get a message about something that they need to pay attention to. But, and they just experienced this magical show called Hairspray that just won the Tony Award, and all these stars are in it, and they just laughed and learned, and all of a sudden they're like, and by the way, as you go out, this is what you need to think about. Like, it was cool to see somebody, an elder do that for us, because I felt like he was doing that for like all gay kind, you know, all of us in the community who were being denied the right to marry at the time, which was what that fight was about.
Mm-hmm.
So it was nice to have that.
Yeah. Michael, I just have a handful of minutes with you. And so here's my last question for you. My understanding is you're going to be touring Catch a Wave come fall 2026.
Yes.
Talk to me about what audiences can expect when you tour come the fall.
Well, you know, we just did the first like live show of this, and you know, I didn't know, all I knew that like I love these songs, and I'm gonna work as hard as I can to get them to the best shape so I could present them. You know, me and the Surf Notes put a bunch of choreography together a la Ronettes, you know, because it's me and two guys, right? It's not, the Beach Boys is a bunch of family members that really had their own thing. With this project, it's I'm kind of like treating it like it's the Ronettes, and you're kind of going through one man's perspective, me, right? You're one guy's perspective. And you know, in normal Beach Boys songs, like you hear like Brian singing the high part, Michael is singing the low part, another guy sings God Only Knows. So throughout the night, you'll hear all those different voices. And in this show, you're going to hear me kind of like hearing the words of Brian Wilson, really the heart and soul of who he was, and the melodies that came out of his mind through one voice. So it's very focused, and I think because of that, it's very theatrical. You know, you kind of go on a ride with these amazing songs that we all kind of know, but like because you're seeing it sung by one person, you're really getting to know these songs in a new and intimate way. And what we didn't expect was the audience to like literally be dancing the entire time. Like even on the ballads, they were like just like swaying and stuff. It was really inspiring. And the song that was like the biggest hit of the night was Kokomo. And I was like, whoa, light bulb. This is staying in. Literally, I mean, I love Kokomo, but like, you know, I didn't realize that everyone loved Kokomo. I mean, people were like swaying. So, you know, I think come to, if you are in a town that we come to, you know, just come with an open heart. You're gonna rock the entire time, and you're gonna learn a lot of stuff.
Well said, well said, well said. Michael Longoria, well said, well done, well recorded. Thanks for your
time. Thank you.
Thanks for being on the show.
I loved it. Please have me again. I would love to talk to you about anything.
That was my spotlight on queer music theater artist Michael Longoria. For more on his latest release, Catch a Wave, simply visit thesurfnotes.com. When did gay pride become just pride?
I can answer that for you, and I can answer where the big turnaround was, and it's a very simple thing. Corporatism is when gay pride became pride. As soon as we got corporate sponsors, as soon as we had the approval of the corporations around us, oh my God, the beer company's going to sponsor it, and they're going to give us a float, and look at the telephone company's going to do something, and someone else is going to do something.
But drop the gay.
Yeah, drop the gay and include everyone. And I always thought, why should we include everyone? This is a gay pride celebration. It is for people who are in a sexual minority. We had something that was for us to make people recognize who we are and to acknowledge that we actually existed.
Award-winning playwright and author Brad Fraser reflects on some important gay history. The time frame, the 1990s. When gay pride becomes pride, with the introduction of corporate sponsorships.
Phone rings. I get a message from the mayor. He's going to call me back the next day. I get the call, and he said, if you'd accept, we'd like to honor you with the key to the city. It was an event later that year in May. Just a key, right? Like, key to what? A decent job, a good singing career. It's really a metaphor, but it's history. So a reporter wants to talk to me and says, so it's a key, right? Like, what's the big deal? I says, well, not everybody gets the key. So I looked it up, and I guess it is kind of a big deal.
The date, May 17th, 2018, when trans activist Susan Gapka made history by becoming the first trans woman to be presented with the key to the city of Toronto. By the way, past recipients include Rush and the Raptors.
Hi, I'm songwriter and producer Jim Valance, and you are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country. From his 2019 album, Like They Do in the Movies, Kiss Me, Like They Do in the Movies, from Michael Longoria.
That you'll never let me go, just like the movies. Kiss me and let me go, just like the movies. You'll be my James Dean, I'll be your Sam Mendes. Now that you're mine, take my hand, baby, let us go. On a fantasy screen where the people know to watch us fall in love. But they've been dreaming of. And we made a video. So many poses, babe, look like a perfect show. But deep inside I asked, why don't I feel it though? Did we fall out of love? We never in love. So kiss me like they do in the movies, like you would in the last row. Come on, let's go. You have to show me now. I want you to touch me.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could borrow a musical instrument free of charge, just like you can borrow books from your local library? We think so too. That's why the